1982, talking to Paul Robinson. We'll start out with where were you born and when?
Okay, Pam, I was born in Milton Vale in June of 1919. In the event you aren't acquainted, Milton Vale is in Cloud County, Kansas, north central Kansas. It had then a population of 813, I believe, and it varies between 800 and 825 through the years. I had my normal grade in high school in Milton Vale and went to Kansas State College in Manhattan for 1 year. It was depression and I was short of funds. I laid out one semester and sold Kansas farm papers, subscriptions door to door in rural Kansas. I went one semester to Milton Vale Wesleyan Junior College in Milton Vale, and it was a very fine, strict little school. I was dropped at the end of my semester for smoking, as smoking and use of alcohol were strictly forbidden. There's my other phone. The next year I attended college at Washburn Municipal University in Topeka, Kansas, and had enrolled the following fall in a few courses in law school at Washburn and some college courses too. But I also enlisted in the Kansas National Guard, as it became evident we were going to be involved in World War II, and we were mobilized that fall. My unit was a quartermaster unit, which became the state headquarters of the Selective Service System. After a few months serving in that office, I was able to attend the first quartermaster officer candidate school in Philadelphia and became a second lieutenant. Went to Fort Warren, Cheyenne for a few months. The first week out, the commanding general rode up on his horse and we exchanged salutes, and he asked me, "Lieutenant Robinson, how many men do you have?" I had a quartermaster company out drilling, and I knew it was supposed to have 100 men, so I responded, "100, sir." And he said, "Mr. Robinson, you have lost 2 men on the drill field." That was my first meeting with a commanding general. That the Wednesday night of that week, it was the custom for all new officers to report to the home of the commanding general and leave a calling card, which I did, and as a random selectee, he invited me in for a few minutes conversation, where I met his daughter and was able to take her to 2 or 3 movies during the time I was stationed there. Then I was transferred to desert training in Southern California, since in my selection of posts which I might desire to serve, I had listed Hawaii, Panama, every place warm. And in the midst of my desert training, I was transferred by Alaska Steam to Bethel, the point of debarkation, and then up the river to McGrath, where I served as post quartermaster from the fall of probably 42 for about 9 or 10 months, and then I was transferred to Juneau as post quartermaster. And after a short year in Juneau, I was transferred into the office of the quartermaster in the headquarters of the Alaska Defense Command at then Fort Richardson, and finished out the period of the war there. I was chief quartermaster for the command during the last year or so of my stay in Alaska.
What was McGrath like when you were there?
We arrived there in the early summer and had a spot on the Kuskokwim River a couple miles from the airfield in the village, and sort of cut our camp out of the woods. They shipped up, the Army shipped up some lumber and tents. We made tent frames, made crude warehouses to cover our groceries and foodstuffs. We had a platoon of infantry to defend the airfield, a platoon of engineers to build the camp, a medical detachment of a captain and six or seven enlisted men, a signal corps detachment of six or seven men, my quartermaster detachment. It went fairly smoothly until the fall rains put the river at flood stage, and our barrels, drums of fuel, which had been unloaded off the river boats, were stacked along the banks and started washing away. We had diesel fuel for heating, some automobile gas, and for some reason, lots and lots of avgas, although we had no airplanes. And as those troubles hit us, our engineer captain went on a prolonged bout of staying inside his cabin with bottles of bourbon. The engineer lieutenant stayed in his cabin trying to invent something out of an alarm clock to control something that we didn't have to operate. And I, by default, became post commander. At that time, the medical captain had refused to move with his medics from the area of the downtown and roadhouses out to our camp, so we had to send hot meals into them on a sled, steel sled pulled by a tractor through the mud. And if men became sick, we had to take them down the same way to see the medics. So I put on my officer of the day armband and my 45 and went in and moved the medical captain and his group out to camp and assigned him to a bunk in my tent, where he was practically a prisoner to the camp. And I wired General Buckner what our situation was, and in a few days he sent out a very beautiful engineering major who took command of the camp and restored order, and progress began.
When did you first start enjoying Alaska, or did you ever enjoy Alaska? You'd wanted all these southern climate posts.
I didn't mind. In fact, I felt fortunate to be serving in Alaska. It turned out to be a good assignment, and I had lots of breaks and good, interesting assignments and promotions. But it never occurred to me while I was on duty up here that I might choose Alaska as a place to live. That came as I finished law school, and I had then a wife and two daughters. I was working part-time in real estate while going to school and supporting the family satisfactorily. But when graduation time came and I realized it was time to be a lawyer, Judge Allen, who had been the dean of the law school and headed the biggest and best law firm in town and who had taught some courses that I enjoyed, offered me a beginning lawyer's job in his firm at $350 a month, which I realized wouldn't sustain us. So then I remembered that Anchorage had a pretty nice climate and some nice people and very few lawyers, and I felt would offer opportunity for a place to work and have a career. So just a day or two after I completed the Kansas bar exam, I bought a new Buick and loaded up my clothing and books and a two-wheel trailer with my law books in it, drove up the highway, and well, I think with those two phone interruptions, we had gotten to Alaska. And with my Army supply experience, I was able to go down to the Alaska Railroad, which was the major employer in the area, and was given the job of traveling steward in charge of their restaurants, bakeries, camp cook facilities for the railroad crews and so on, and the bar car on the train. I rode the train back and forth between Seward and Fairbanks for several months, supervising the operations I had mentioned, which gave me a good opportunity to read the Alaska statutes, which I think were contained in only three volumes, certainly not over that at that time. In fact, the three-volume compilation didn't come out until 49. And I worked in that position on the railroad until October of that year, when I wrote the Alaska bar exam. I wrote it in Anchorage. It was given once a year. There were three examiners: Ralph Rivers, the territorial attorney general; Warren Cuddy, who was president of the First National Bank and had his own law office; father of Dan Cuddy, who is an inactive member of our bar association. There were three applicants in Alaska that fall for the exam. I was the only one at Anchorage, and I was directed to report in to Mr. Cuddy for the exam, which I did. Mr. Cuddy was a very pleasant, genial man, and he showed me a small room in the back of his office where I could write the exam. It was his law library. He said, if I cared to, feel free to use any of his books, but I didn't find that necessary. In fact, I wouldn't have known how to use them. They were old brown-covered books that I had never seen before, but having fairly recently written the Kansas exam, and having read the Alaska statutes, I made it through the Alaska exam in good shape. Then after writing the Alaska exam, I went out to the Corps of Engineers and was able to obtain a position just recently vacated as head of their real estate department, which managed all of the real estate under the control of the various branches of the military in Alaska. And I found that very interesting, handling their leasing and visiting the various communities in Alaska where the military had property. And I did that from October until April, when my job took me to southeast Alaska, Sitka and Juneau. So while in Juneau, I called on Ralph Rivers, the Attorney General, introduced myself, told him I'd written the bar exam in October, and asked him how it was progressing. He said, oh, you passed. Hadn't you heard? And with that good news, I came back to Anchorage and selected Davis and Renfrew as the law office I thought I would like to work in. went down and talked to Bill Renfrew for about 15 or 20 minutes, told him how good I was, and he said, well, I think you're hired. And he took me in and introduced me to Ed Davis, and I was hired, and I worked there in their firm for 2 or 2.5 years.
Can you tell me a little bit about Warren Cutting before we move into the Renfrew? What kind of practice did he have?
Well, as I remember Warren, he wore his glasses on his forehead, usually in his shirt sleeves, a little bit on the successfully heavy side. I never saw him angry with anyone. He went to court occasionally, but he was not one who spent a lot of time in court trying cases. My impression of his practice was that he settled disputes and controversies. Two parties with a problem would come to Warren, and he would work it out for them, tell them what the solution would be, or who was more correct than the other, and how they should settle it. And I really think that was typical and the type of practice he mostly followed. I think that's a fair appraisal, yes. He would draw deeds and handle, I think, uncontested divorces at times and advise business clients. As president of the bank, which was on the same street and in the same block, he was back and forth between the bank and his office, and I expect a lot of his legal clients were also banking clientele. I didn't practice in his office or have much contact with him in the practice of law, but when I did, it was pleasant.
Could he practice at the same time? He could hold both jobs. It wasn't too much.
He was permitted that, yes. Different from now, I know. Some years back, Dan Cuddy was president of the bank and doing some law practice, but the banking authorities, national banking authorities, as Dan told me, stated that he had to do one or the other. If he was going to run the bank, that would be
his job.
His job, yes.
How many lawyers are in town when you were here at the very beginning? This is 1948, isn't it?
Yes, I think not over a dozen. There were Davis and Renfrew, McCutcheon and Nesbitt, Grigsby, Warren Cuddy, Carl Draper, Drager. I didn't get acquainted with him. He was here in the very early time I was here, and I don't remember whether he came a little after I got into practice or a little before.
What about Roach?
Oh, yes. Judge Roach or Cappy Roach. Yes, he practiced in a little log cabin, I think in the lot next to Snow White Laundry on I Street. And he had been magistrate, hence his designation as judge. And I think he did quite a little bit in real estate contracts and deeds. But I didn't remember him as one who was trying cases in the courthouse. Bill mostly was a trial lawyer. He had a high percentage of the criminal defense work in town and tried civil cases as well. He was very colorful in office and in court. Normally on Monday morning, the office would have several people who had been charged with various infractions of the law, some pimping, prostitution, small crimes, and Bill would get their names and the copy of the ticket. If they had money to retain him at the moment, if they didn't, he'd tell them to go out and make it and come back and see him. A lot of those cases didn't go to extensive trials. They were in city court. I think Buell Nesbitt was the city magistrate during a good part of those early years. I think Bill Olson was city magistrate for a year or so. But I think, well, all violations of city ordinances, and except felony cases. I think felony cases all went to the district court. So many of these city court cases would be pled out with a small fine, maybe a small suspended sentence, or a day or two to do, or if they couldn't plead them out, often they just moved on and forfeited their small bail. Bill handled larger cases too, of all varieties. He had a mannerism, and he never told me whether it was an act that he devised or whether it was just something that had grown on him. But normally when he went into district court for a full trial, he would, it seemed to me, do everything possible to alienate the jury and antagonize the prosecutor and have the judge unhappy with him. But as he worked through the trial, you could see the attitude of the participants in the case changing to Bill, and finding that even though he was on the rough side and a little outspoken, he seemed to be a good-hearted fellow doing his best for his client, and he won a good percentage of his cases. He did an excellent job. I think if he'd had more competition, and if there'd been more travel in between Alaska and the western states, he would have been rated one of the best trial lawyers on the West Coast.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember any cases in particular?
Oh, yes, a couple stand out. One, the Scattered Edwards case. He tried that for about 2 weeks and had me sit in with him for the reason that he had a safari scheduled in Africa. Didn't know how long the case would last, but had to go forward with the case. In this case, Scatter Edwards, who had been a tail gunner on a bomber in World War II, had operated a little establishment around Anchorage for a while, but had prospered sufficiently to build a nice big two-story house down on Spinard Road, where the Westchester Lagoon would be now, and had imported a couple pretty good-looking girls from Canada to serve as hostesses and business ladies of the establishment. And on the night before he was opening to the public, he and his associate and perhaps other friends were having a private party when a longtime Spinard resident who developed a subdivision on South Spinard Road and had heard that the establishment was there came down hopefully to be one of the first customers. But the doors were locked, and Scatter told Frank to go away, and Frank didn't, and set up quite a nuisance and commotion. So Scatter went out to run him off, but Frank attacked Scatter with a garden rake. So Scatter went back in and got his handgun and came out and chased Frank off and chased him. They were running down Spinard Road in their two automobiles with Scatter firing his handgun at Frank, with the result that Scatter was charged with attempt to kill or do bodily harm, and Renfrew was trying the case. And he made a beautiful circus out of it. This guy's defending his unopened whorehouse from an unwanted attacker, and it was a riot. The courtroom was full all the time, and everybody was having fun, and Judge Diamond was having difficulty restraining his humor as well. And sure enough, on Friday night, when the evidence was completed, Bill had to leave for a safari, and it left me to do the closing argument on Monday. And I was not able to keep the comic status and the sense of humor and the glee that Bill had built up and perpetuated. I argued it in more serious vein, and darn if the jury didn't come in with a conviction for poor Scatter. Yeah.
What did Renfrew say when he came back?
I think he could hardly believe it. I don't know. I think he couldn't see how I could have lost that case that he had in such beautiful shape when he left for Africa. Another case Bill tried in Anchorage that I sat in on, a prominent merchant down at Dillingham or Knack-Knack, I've forgotten which. You got that one. All right.
Yeah,
got that.
Yeah,
we did.
How did Davis and Renfrew work together? Did they each take a separate area of the law?
They complemented each other very well. They were so different. Davis was the student. All the law books were in his office, and he did any research that was necessary for his case or Bill's, and wrote any briefs that were necessary or any appeals. And Bill had business clients. Particularly, I recall Milt Odom was a close friend and good business client of his. They would come in for consultations, and Bill would sometimes get out of contract. But Bill loved life. He didn't spend time preparing cases. While the prosecution or plaintiff put on their evidence, he was thinking about what his defense would be and finding out who his witnesses were going to be, and just worked the case while it was in trial.
Did he ever get fouled up doing that?
Oh, I've seen him get in some pretty deep holes and get some surprises, but he always landed on both feet, and I don't think any, of course we didn't have a grievance procedure then, but I don't recall any or many instances of clients saying, "Renfrew, you didn't get ready, you blew my case."
What was the bar like? Was it organized? Was there any kind of procedure for disciplining attorneys?
Not that I knew of. I expect if an attorney embezzled or did something horrible, it would be brought to the attention of the district court, and the district judge would mete out whatever might be appropriate. But I don't recall examples of attorneys having to be disciplined. The the only organization I saw was an informal Saturday luncheon and drinking party at the Aleutian Gardens or the Club Lido, sometimes followed by a poker game or a crap game.
I hadn't heard about the Aleutian Gardens.
That was regular Saturday. Mm-hmm. They were lots of fun.
Did all the members of the bar come?
Most of them attended, yes. Yeah.
What about the women members? Were there any women?
Dorothy Tyner, she was usually in attendance, yes. I don't think she was in Anchorage yet at those years. I don't recall her attending our informal meetings.
Were minutes kept to those meetings?
No, Fairbanks Bar Association does much better, but we didn't keep minutes. And we didn't have dues.
No dues?
No. Well, I don't think we had officers. We just had a consensus on where we were going to meet.
Did the bars ever get together? The Fairbanks Bar ever come down to Anchorage? Or Anchorage go to Fairbanks?
No. No, we had no joint meetings. No.
No joint sessions. You better get to work on them. Why don't we move to, Wilkie Jefferson, that was one other person I wanted to ask you about.
Yes, Will had been here a long time before I came. He was not a lawyer, he was a litigant, however, a frequent litigant.
Did he hold himself out as a lawyer to
people? Not openly, he didn't have an office or a sign or pass out cards, but Will, I think, was not actually in Anchorage when I came into Davis and Renfrew. He had been sentenced after being found guilty of forgery. Ed Davis had, I understood, had defended him in that case and believed in his innocence and continued to believe in it for some time. But when Will came back, he got himself into court frequently over questions of title to property. He often became involved, I think, in fictitious names and partnerships and claiming interest in property and got into numerous trials over those questionable property interests. And as late as 5 or 6 years ago, I think, our office got involved in a rather complex property case in which he showed up as an assignee of a partnership interest in a downtown cafe. And our office represented a nice little old woman who had put in all the money to...
Not a widow.
yes, nice little old widow. to get the cafe established, and she had made some oral agreement with a subsequent boyfriend that he could have the card game concession and run the night shift of the cafe. So he thought he was a partner, and he assigned his partnership interest to Wilkie Jefferson, and we were involved in litigation with Wilkie to try to save the nice little old lady's business. But, other people he did sub rosa legal work for, drew pleadings and coached them on how the strategy of their cases. I've had one or two instances when people have written me saying that they had had spent all their available cash on Will Key, and their case wasn't going satisfactorily. Could I help them out? So he was not a lawyer, and he didn't openly hold himself out to be, but people heard of his interests and went to him for help. Well, many of them, he would work up enough of a showing that he was a party in interest, that he could have his name on the pleadings. He was also very quick to attempt to block the effect of municipal or borough ordinances that he didn't agree with. He challenged their constitutionality and take them through the court. The municipal official bodies became very tired of being harassed by Wilkie.
Did the bar ever try to do anything about Wilkie? Did they ever try to publicize that he wasn't a lawyer and wouldn't go to Wilkie Jefferson?
No, I think mostly we just attempted to avoid getting involved with him. He was good at telling the young lawyers in the halls of the courtroom, I'll show you how to practice law. And he'd paper them to death.
Was there any kind of division between the bar and the bench in the early years? I'm talking about before Judge Diamond, or even not even just with Judge Diamond, but any kind of division between people who are commissioners and magistrates and
Not that I recall. I think we all had respect for each other and got along well. Occasionally there'd be a magistrate who didn't seem to know much. When I was first here, there was a lovable old magistrate lady named Rose Walsh. She had not gone to law school, but she was a nice woman and tried to be fair. One of her example of fairness was that you could expect if you won one case, you'd lose the next one. Mm-hmm. And she did have a practice of going around the community after a case had been heard in her court and talking to other people to see what they thought about it, and sometimes continued to form her opinion from material she gathered, but she tried to do justice. Nobody ever abused her or tried to have her thrown out of office. I can remember one instance when Roger Cremo had filed a complaint against one of my clients. And Roger was noted for brevity in his pleadings. But I don't know whether this was the first time that this had happened. Anyway, I went in and moved to dismiss because it was too short. And Rose granted my motion. And the next time Roger filed a complaint against one of my clients, I answered with a general denial, and he moved to have my answer dismissed because it was too short, and she granted it. But as far as division with the judges, I can only speak really for this third division. Everybody loved, admired, and respected Judge Diamond, and the other visiting judges, when they came, were courteous and polite, and seemed to be well trained for their positions, and as nearly as I could tell, the lawyers all respected them.
Mm-hmm. What visiting judges besides Judge Folter came?
Well, Judge Folter seemed to come the most, particularly in criminal cases. I think Judge Kehoe, I don't remember whether he was Fairbanks or Nome, or maybe he...
Yeah.
He came down occasionally. Judge Helenthal from the First Division came up occasionally. He was a fine man, too.
did in the early 1950s when you were busy in Republican politics, and Eisenhower had come in, and you were supposed to be going to appoint a new judge. What kind of procedure did you go through, or what were the circumstances surrounding it?
Well, the people in the administration who had an interest in both selection of someone with judicial qualifications, but also with Republican Party qualifications, asked some of us to send in some names. We had very few Republican lawyers here at that time, and Harold Stringer was active in the party. I remember that he and I discussed it several times, discussed it with other active Republicans here, and our first consensus was that it would be difficult to replace Judge Diamond, and that we weren't that hungry for political patronage, where we had a very fine, well-liked jurist on the bench. So I don't remember whether Harold went with me or whether I went alone, but I did talk with Judge Diamond in his chambers and told him that we would be pleased if he would care to continue as the U.S. District Judge here. And he didn't even think it over for a day or two. His response was that he had been a political appointment and he had enjoyed his service, and now he would step aside and make room for a new appointment. And he did. I think he stayed on the bench until an appointment was named. There may have been an open period, but he didn't. He stayed in for a while. We had asked Ed Arnell, who's since deceased, if he would be interested in the judgeship, and he declined. Neither Harold Stringer nor I wanted to take on the responsibilities. J.L. McCary was willing to be considered, and we did consume so much time that we were put under some pressure that they would proceed with appointment of a non-Alaskan, and did send one man, Mr. Orth, up to visit the community and to be looked over, and for a while we really had the impression that maybe we'd lost our opportunity to have an Alaskan named. When Orth was here, several of us entertained him. The Bar Association entertained him. Then I remember going with McCutcheon and Nesbitt and Stringer and several others, I don't remember who, flew over to Alexander Lake for a part of a weekend. But as it turned out, a good percentage of the Anchorage Bar rallied to support McCary, and McCary was nominated.
Mm-hmm. Did the practice change in the 50s?
Yes, I suppose it was always changing, but it became noticeable in the 50s. We had more attorneys, and the informality began to disappear. There was not nearly the ease in which you'd call another attorney and make a telephone stipulation and know that that was it, and you didn't have to file motions and get written stipulations and get hearings in court on procedural matters. Trial setting was informal. I had calls of the calendar, but in the 50s that got to be an ordeal, sometimes an all day long, one Friday a month or one Monday a month. on what the status of all the cases that had been filed were, and that it got to be just more nuisance work than there had been before, and some antagonisms began to develop. I don't remember much as to between whom. I got along pretty well with all the lawyers and didn't really find myself in much friction, but I was aware there was some.
Was there an effort to do something about the system to make it more manageable?
Well, the Integrated Bar Act came in about mid-50s, I think. And that then we start getting written rules. There was a little tiny handbook of rules of practice in the district court, but it was just a few pages thick. I think it was a handbook of rules of practice in the U.S. District Court and Admiralty Court. And I think Harold Stringer was appointed, oh, about 48 or 50 to work on revisions, but he never made any report, and so we didn't have any revisions for several years.
Who was he appointed by?
I think by the district judge. The judge may have asked for volunteers, and maybe we volunteered Harold.
Was Harold Stringer active in bar?
Yes, he was a regular attender at our meetings. Well, he was a politician in the bar. Yes.
How does someone become a politician in the bar? What do you?
Well,